From Cafe and the Vox Media Podcast Network, welcome to Stay Tuned. I'm Preet Bharara.
The Trump folks, you asked how they feel, do see it as something of a gift that the Manhattan DA case went first, because they think that it is the most trivial of the cases. They like to say weak. I don't actually think it is a weak case. The question is whether people think that it should have been brought.
That's Maggie Haberman. She's a senior political correspondent at the New York Times, where she won a Pulitzer Prize for her reporting on Donald Trump's top advisors and their connections to Russia. She's written about the former president for decades, reporting extensively on him since 2016. Over the last couple of weeks on this podcast, we have focused on the legal implications of Trump's indictment in Manhattan. So I wanted to speak with Maggie about the political impact. How might the charges play out in the GOP presidential primary? How is the White House responding? And how is Trump personally handling all of this? That's coming up. Stay tuned.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brené Brown, and I'd love to tell you about my podcast, Dare to Lead. Innovation, creativity, building a better, more just world, all of these things require absolutely courageous leadership, especially given the complexity and chaos of the world right now. The Dare to Lead podcast is a collection of conversations with change catalysts, culture shifters, some troublemakers, folks who are really daring to create and change the world. I hope you join us.
Now let's get to your questions. This question comes in a tweet from Leon. Do you think the Trump stolen documents case will result in indictments soon? So that's a great question. I like the way you have asked the question super neutrally, the Trump stolen documents case. You're, of course, Leon, referring to the investigation that has been taken over by special counsel Jack Smith at the Justice Department relating to documents found at Mar-a-Lago, over 100 classified documents. There was a long back and forth, as you may recall, are talking about and from other news reports between Trump, the people around Trump, and the Justice Department and the National Archives. I think that the signs are there that an indictment is likely and probably not too far off. That's in part because it's not that complicated a case. There are not that many witnesses you have to bring to bear in the grand jury. There are not that many documents you have to deal with. The theory of the case is rather simple. I think the reporting and the information we have otherwise indicates that it's not likely to be a prosecution, if there is one, based on the mishandling of classified documents per se, but rather the narrative that's being developed by Jack Smith through putting people in the grand jury and otherwise is that Donald Trump intentionally obstructed an investigation about the documents. So it's an obstruction charge, probably, not a mishandling of classified documents charge. No case is simple and no case is fully straightforward. But of the four things that Donald Trump is facing, prosecution in Manhattan, prosecution in Georgia, the investigation that Jack Smith is also doing relating to the events of January 6th, and this Mar-a-Lago documents matter, the Mar-a-Lago documents matter is probably the simplest and most straightforward and the least sprawling. The other signs that an indictment is likely to happen is the speed with which Jack Smith seems to be proceeding in the aggressiveness with which he seems to be proceeding. There's significant reporting from the Washington Post, from great reporters there in the last 10 days or so, that talks about all the new pieces of evidence that Jack Smith seems to have, including video evidence. This bit of reporting is pretty astonishing. Let me quote from the Washington Post article for a moment. Quote, in the classified documents case, federal investigators have gathered new and significant evidence that after the subpoena was delivered, remember, a subpoena went to Donald Trump after it was certified that all the documents had been turned over. So after the subpoena was delivered, according to the Washington Post, Trump looked through the contents of some of the boxes of documents in his home, apparently out of a desire to keep certain things in his possession. The people familiar with the investigation said. Let me read further. Investigators now suspect, based on witness statements, security camera footage, and other documentary evidence, that boxes including classified material were moved from a Mar-a-Lago storage area after the subpoena was served, and that Trump personally examined at least some of those boxes, these people said. The Post some months earlier reported that Trump's valet told investigators that he moved boxes at Mar-a-Lago at the former president's instruction after the subpoena was issued. So you have multiple examples, according to this reporting, if it can be believed, but it's credible, that Donald Trump himself, looked at documents, sifted through documents, tried to keep documents, ordered other people to move documents. The fact that all this is being leaked and being discovered by the press and the nature of the case as a general matter caused me to cautiously predict that there will be an indictment, notwithstanding the fact that there's also an investigation going on with respect to classified documents found at facilities that were being used by former Vice President Joe Biden and former Vice President Mike Pence. I'll be right back with my conversation with Maggie Haberman.
Support for this show comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise, an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab, tracks the stories making news right now and breaks them down for the average investor. Host Mike Townsend, Charles Schwab's Managing Director for Legislative and Regulatory Affairs, takes a nonpartisan look at the stories that matter most to investors. He explores topics like policy initiatives for retirement savings, taxes, and trade, inflation fears, the Federal Reserve, and how regulatory developments can affect companies, sectors, and even the entire market. In every episode, Mike and his guests offer their perspectives on how policy changes could affect what you do with your portfolio. Download the latest episode and follow at schwab.com/WashingtonWise or wherever you listen.
Support for this show comes from NetSuite. The less your business spends on operations, multiple systems, and delivering your product, the more margin you have to keep the money you've earned. But that's hard to do with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is a top-rated cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/preet. 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 What is Donald Trump's next move after being indicted by the Manhattan DA? There isn't a reporter around who knows the former reality TV star and president better than senior New York Times political correspondent Maggie Haberman. Maggie Haberman, welcome back to the show.
Preet, thanks for having me.
It's hard to believe that it's been over 5 years since you were here back in 2018.
That is hard to believe.
Did you forget about us?
I definitely did not forget about you. I didn't realize that it had been that long, but you're right.
It's kind of crazy.
Lots happened since then.
Lots happened, and a lot hasn't happened.
That's also true. that is also true, and when you put it that way.
So I want to tell you about a memory I have from the last time we were together on the podcast. So 5 years and change ago, before the pandemic, the great COVID-19, we were in person. And today you are in a home and I'm in a home, so I can't see you. And so I can't make this observation today, but I made it the last time we were on the podcast together. And you're a busy person. I'm a busy person. And we like to be responsive and we like to be connected. And maybe we both, I would dare to say, have an unhealthy addiction to our phones. Mm. And there have been times when I see other people in the middle of a conversation, even I dare say in the middle of an interview, I might check my phone. Maybe there's a message from the team. Maybe my family needs to reach me when the other person is speaking. So I might check my phone when I'm listening. I saw you texting during the interview while you were speaking. That I've never seen before. In the middle of a podcast interview, you picked up your phone. Listeners wouldn't know it or would have gotten that you were doing that, other than your speech got just a little bit slower.
It's just a mild, embarrassed laugh that I did that. But yes, I'd like to tell you that it was an isolated incident, Preet, and that, you know, I learned.
The texting and speaking, I've never seen.
Well, it's probably not advisable. I try to do it less than I used to. I think at that period of time when I was on in 2018, I'm trying to remember exactly what month it was, but 2018 was the year that Michael Cohen's office and home were searched by the FBI, and the year when we were reporting after the Wall Street Journal first broke the news about the payment from Cohen to Stormy Daniels, that Cohen acknowledged to me that he had made this payment. And then we had Cohen pleading guilty. And so I feel like there were all kinds of things that might have required my picking up my
phone. Required in that moment. Okay.
Yes.
Well, I'm going to let that go. We'll come back
Thank
to it.
Thank you. Later. Okay. I appreciate it. Table it, if you will.
We'll
now.
Table it. Yes. We'll circle back, as they say.
Thank you. Good. Very good.
Now let's level set. There are these terms that people use that we didn't used to use before.
That's so true.
I don't even know what level set means, but I hear it all the time.
You know what? It could be emotional level setting. It could be technology level setting. Who knows? It could be anything.
Well, on the podcast, level setting means something different. Anyway, so obviously we need to talk about the gigantic news of recent days. We're recording this on Monday, April 10th, in the morning. Donald Trump has been indicted. He has been arraigned. I feel like you know his psychology and the psychology of people around him better than any other reporter, and you've talked a little bit about this. What's his mood? What's the mood of the people around him? How are they handling this?
So his mood has broken into a couple of different parts. You know, there was the sort of pseudo heady diving in before the actual indictment and almost trying to dare the Manhattan District Attorney to indict him, suggesting that, you know, telling
dare accepted.
Right, exactly. Yes, challenge met. Trying to insist to people around him that he, you know, this was a fun experience. He was excited for a possible perp walk. You know, this was, bravado. You know, this is something that he has sought to avoid for a very long time, which is getting indicted. And with an indictment comes an arrest. So, and Donald Trump, for all of his eccentricities, shall we say, and ways in which that he is different from other people, I don't think he's so different that he actually wants to be arrested. In fact, I'm quite sure of it. So there was that show of bravado until the actual indictment happened. And the indictment caught him and a number of members of his team by surprise, in part because they had convinced themselves that, you know, the case was falling apart. They believed reports. And then I think in some cases, stuff they were hearing on their own, that the grand jury that had been sitting and hearing the case was adjourned for a month. That obviously turned out not to be true. So all of that then leads into the actual arraignment day / arrest. And, you know, he was not throwing staplers or furniture or what have you, but he was very angry about the indictment. He did not want to be arrested. The look on his face, Preet, when he went into the courtroom, and, you know, the image has now been seen all over the place, said it all. And what was interesting is in the courtroom, when he was sitting at the defense table and he was flanked by lawyers, and one camera was, I think it was just one camera, was allowed into the courtroom to take what I think was a pool shot. And Trump apparently locked eyes on that camera, on the lens. He knew what he wanted to look like in that shot. And this is a guy who, as you know, spends a lot of time thinking about visuals. I think he had put a lot of time into what the physicality was going to be of this moment. And then
how would you describe the look? How would you describe the look?
Resigned and somewhat defiant. You know, there were times that I looked at that photo and I thought he looked pretty tired, honestly. But he was definitely resigned and sort of dug in. And then he went back to Florida, and then he was in a great mood, and he was making a show of letting everyone see that he was in a great mood, because that is what he has done when the chips are down for decades. You know, he shows that he's doing just fine. And so, you know, I think the people around him, a number of people said to me that Tuesday, that the arrest day last week, was very intense. It was exhausting. They weren't quite sure what to expect. It was, you know, a little daunting being in that situation with him. And then they felt like they had survived it and got out. And then on they go. Now, they believe politically this indictment is going to help them in the Republican primary. It certainly seems to have given Trump at least a short-term boost. I don't know that that will be the case if there are other indictments, but I think that's where they are right now.
Who is he angry at other than Alvin Bragg?
He is angry at, that's a good question. He is angry at Michael Cohen. He is angry at Stormy Daniels. He is angry at, the press. He is angry at Republicans who are not with him. He is angry. You know, one of the things that I have heard a lot since he left office from people who have spoken to him is that he's quicker to anger. And that makes a lot of sense. And so I think you're seeing some of that right now.
I think you've written that, and others have written, that he's afraid. He was afraid of this.
Yes.
What does that mean? And why is he afraid, given that on so many other occasions he's avoided accountability under the law?
Well, so I would just say a couple of things. There aren't actually that many times prior to the presidency when he avoided accountability under the law, you know, in criminal investigations. He was criminally investigated in 1979 by Ed Corman, who was then the Brooklyn federal prosecutor. I should caveat that, and I did not know this obviously at the time, but Ed Corman performed my wedding ceremony. And then I found out in the last couple of years that he had played this role in investigating Trump. It was a quick 6-month investigation with a looming statute of limitations approaching on fraud. And it related to how Trump had acquired a parcel of land in Manhattan. Case didn't go anywhere. It became sort of a template for Trump in terms of, you know, schmoozing and dealing and him believing, and I don't think this is why, but he believed that, you know, he had escaped this by dint of his charm and his ability to talk to investigators. And he made a habit of collecting prosecutors over the years. But the reality is that in terms of just, you know, associations, but the reality is that other than, you know, a 2013 investigation by Cy Vance, Alvin Bragg's predecessor, into a deal that Trump's children were involved with in Soho, there haven't been a ton of criminal investigations related to Trump. Most of his legal issues have been civil. And, you know, they really became criminal when he became president. And, or at least I would say actually even in the 2016 campaign when there was this counterintelligence investigation that was opened. And so when he was president, there was never going to be an indictment of a sitting president. So he's avoided it, you know, I think just by virtue of sort of either people not looking for something or because whatever he was doing, you know, did not merit an investigation or, you know, on and on and on. But I think that the sort of the threat of being investigated, the threat of people, the government coming for you has always loomed very large for him. And that's why I believe he was afraid of this. And I think it's, you know, most importantly, Preet, it's out of his control. And he is someone who so prizes control in everything he does that I think that it's hard to ignore.
Well, it's not quite out of his control. The thing I was going to ask you is, you know, has it ever occurred to Donald Trump over the course of years and decades that one way to avoid scrutiny is not to do shady stuff? You can make the argument that you're a certain kind of person. I don't believe this to be true. And you'll attract attention because of politics or whatever. But, you know, when you engage in certain kinds of behavior, like calling up, you know, the president of Ukraine and engaging in extortion or fomenting violence at the Capitol or taking classified documents and not returning them, or lying about a retainer to, you know, all these things were totally in his control. How does he think about that? Do you know?
He doesn't think about that as something that was his responsibility. You know, he should be allowed to do what he wants, and people coming for him are the threat. I mean, this is somebody who has behaved throughout his existence as if systems and rules should not apply to him. And that was certainly true in the presidency. That's sort of what you're talking about in terms of that phone call to the Ukrainian president, Zelensky. And so, you know, I think the way he thinks about this is, can you believe this is happening to me?
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Victim. Victim,
yeah.
Victim, victim.
Yeah.
How does he think about his lawyers? I mean, famously, people have talked about, because that's super interesting to me as a lawyer and, you know, been on both sides of this. Famously, he had Roy Cohn as his lawyer. You've mentioned another lawyer who he's angry at, Michael Cohen, who was his right-hand man, helped him facilitate the payments to Stormy Daniels, which are at the center of the charges, obviously against Michael Cohen, and now also at the center of the charges against Donald Trump. He's had other lawyers who've gotten in trouble, including Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell, who have had been sanctioned by the court. Most recently, he added a lawyer who used to work for me, who's a very good and smart attorney, Todd Blanch. Talk a little bit about how he thinks about lawyers and how his feelings about lawyers and his selection of lawyers has evolved, if at all, over time.
Sure. My colleague Jonathan Swan and I just actually wrote a story about this that ran over the weekend about Trump and lawyers. And, you know, he has spent decades trying to have people serve in the model of Roy Cohn, who was his first, you know, real fixer lawyer. And, you know, everyone else has been some semblance of that. Obviously, nobody was Roy Cohn for a variety of reasons, one of which is that Roy Cohn is very smart. But Roy Cohn himself was indicted.
Wait, you're saying that's different from
I'm saying that not everybody, not for all of his lawyers, to be clear. But there are certainly members of his team, you know, over the years who have not been Clarence Darrow. I think that, you know, Roy Cohn also was in legal trouble himself repeatedly, and acquitted or ended in a mistrial on the four indictments. Ultimately, he was disbarred not long before his death. But, you know, that is what Trump seeks. Trump likes lawyers who generally will do anything. And he has been looking for that as you know, as long as history goes back with him. Todd Blanch is a bit of a different fit. You know, Todd Blanch
He's actually smart and competent.
Yeah, he's a good lawyer. He's a solid lawyer. And there are other solid lawyers around Trump right now. Chris Keyes from Florida is a solid lawyer. There are other people who, you know, Susan Nicholas, who has worked with the Trump Organization for a while, Alan Feuerfass, who was part of the Trump Organization trial. These are real lawyers. But then he has a bunch of people who he likes to see go on television. And it's not that they're not real lawyers, but they are people who he likes to see in a certain casting role. And that is one of the questions that he tends to ask people, which is, we go on TV. You know, can you go on TV? Can you fight? Can you do this? Right. Can you do that?
Like, and Joe Tacopina, for example.
Yeah. So Joe Tacopina, it's funny. Joe Tacopina has been around New York legal circles for a very, very long time. I first met Joe in 2000 when he was representing one of the cops in the second trial related to the Abner Louima police brutality case when I was covering Brooklyn Federal Court. And so Joe has been a, you know, very combative legal presence for a very long time. Some of his appearances on television have been pretty criticized by other members of Trump's team who felt that those appearances were unhelpful. But Trump really liked him because he was fighting. And so that is what Trump really values. Trump had this line to me when I interviewed him for my book on him in one of three interviews. This was the first one in March of 2021. I asked him, other than Roy Cohn, who had been, you know, who were good lawyers for him. And the only other person he mentioned was Jay Goldberg, who had represented him in his divorce with Ivana Trump. I believe Jay Goldberg has passed away since. But he talked about, you know, he was quick on his feet. He was a great Harvard student. He was quick on his feet. So right there are the two credentials. One is, you know, a marquee law school, and one is quick on his feet, whatever that means. And then Trump went on to say, you know, a lot of these, I'm paraphrasing, but it was a lot of these lawyers, you know, they choke when the press calls, when you call, you know, when the press calls, they choke. And that really is how he sees this. It's all sort of how you handle him in public representation, as opposed to legal representation.
So do you have any inside scoop about the Todd Blanch appointment?
Well, Todd Blanch also represents one of Trump's in-house counsels, Boris Epstein. And Boris Epstein played a role in Blanch getting hired. Trump, I'm told, also sought the view of Paul Manafort, who was, I think his name is probably pretty familiar to your listeners, but he was the campaign chairman in 2016. He became ensnared in the Mueller probe into possible ties between the campaign and Russian officials. He did serve jail time, other than Michael Cohen. I think he's really the only one who did. And Trump ultimately pardoned him. But Blanch represented Manafort in a New York case related to Manafort, and that case was dismissed. And so I believe that Manafort talked him up to Trump as well.
Do you think that the strategy for Trump, legal and otherwise, but mostly I'm talking about legal strategy, is what I think you've written before, attack the prosecutors and delay as much as possible? And given the timetable of the election, how do you think they're thinking about timing of a trial?
It's a really good question. So what came up in the court hearing during the arraignment was that, you know, Trump's earliest return date, I believe, is going to be December.
It's pretty far away.
It's pretty far away. And then the prosecutors were talking about a very quick trial start after that in January. I think Trump's lawyers wanted to push it back. I believe it was as far back as September of 2024, which obviously would get it to be, you know, right before the general election. That all assumes that Trump is the nominee, which the polls at the moment certainly indicate is the likeliest, although it's a poll in April, so who knows? But April of the out year. Chris Kai is one of Trump's lawyers who I mentioned, who's not, you know, an attorney of record on the case involving Alvin Bragg, but Trump's various lawyers all have some level of visibility into various cases. And Kai had suggested to me that, you know, speed would actually, and transparency are actually Trump's friends in this case, because he believes the facts are generally on Trump's side. But so far, I've seen no indication that Trump's lawyers are going to do anything other than take as long as possible.
But does he want, it's a sort of political and legal judgment, do you think he wants the trial to be pending at the time of the election or to have been completed by the time of the election? There's a little risk in that, no?
There is a little risk in that. I think that his habit is just to delay as long as possible. And I don't think that he's looking at, you know, a weighty calculation of exactly what days might look like. I think he just wants to push it back as long as he can.
Yeah. Do you think the lawyers have a sense or some consensus about how weak or strong the charges are? You mentioned one of them just thinks that the facts are on Trump's side. Is that the consensus?
That's generally the consensus, yeah. I mean, most of them think that this is a case that they can have a decent amount of luck with in pretrial motions. I'm obviously not a lawyer, so I don't know enough to know if that's true. But I think they think that they can have some luck there. I think that they are all aware that Manhattan is not a particularly hospitable jury pool for Donald Trump. You know, there are parts of Manhattan that are more favorable to him than others, but it's tough.
And what is their expectation with respect to these other three potential criminal cases against him?
It's a really good question. So Georgia is the case that Trump in particular has been very worried about, although I would say he's now quite worried about the boxes case, the Mar-a-Lago boxes case as well. Georgia, I think, you know, and this I'm just surmising, is nervous making to him because he's on tape.
But it was a perfect call.
Right. So putting that aside, I think that's a part of it. The Mar-a-Lago boxes case is a concern to Trump's advisors. They see how aggressively the federal prosecutors and investigators are looking at this. And I think the fact that some of his advisors have made very clear that not only the prosecutors, but at least the previous chief judge overseeing the grand jury, Beryl Howell, who has since left that post and has been replaced by Judge Boasberg. But Howell, they believed in her rulings, made pretty plain she considers what, you know, what one advisor said to me is that Trump is a criminal. And so I don't think they feel great about that case.
They don't feel emboldened over time with respect to the documents case when it was discovered that Biden had classified documents and Pence had classified documents.
They felt great about that. those were very useful headlines.
Those were the days. That was heady.
Those were great moments for them. But those are hard to sustain when there are still a bunch of other, you know, legal facts. So they felt great about what that meant as they were. I mean, one of the things, and I think we talked about this the last time I was here, although as you pointed out, it was much longer ago than I realized. Trump, part of his MO is always to conflate PR issues with legal issues. And so the fact that Biden had boxes of documents, or what, not even boxes of documents, he had some documents. Pence had some documents. I think it was a very, very small fraction of how many Trump had. But that became a discussion of, look, everyone does it. Everyone has it. It's a way to just sort of muddy the waters. Muddying the waters doesn't really work with prosecutors. It works in public. It can work with a judge, maybe.
I can speak from experience.
Yeah. And so I think there's the, you know, there's the, there, he, Trump is increasingly experiencing a schism between his PR efforts and his legal efforts in a way that he really rarely has.
I'll be right back with Maggie Haberman
after this.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prop G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Gary Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prop G Pod, we bring you insights from blue flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. And not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds four times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
Hey, everyone. This is Jesse David Fox, host of Good One, a podcast about jokes. I am proud to announce that I have personally won the Streaming Wars. And there's a new docuspecial on Peacock based on our own Vulture podcast. Good One, a show about jokes, follows Mike Birbiglia as he develops new material, taking audiences through the process of transforming personal stories into stand-up. Featuring interviews with Mike's family and comedy colleagues like Seth Meyers, Hasan Minhaj, and Asko Akatsuka, Good One, a show about jokes, is streaming now only on Peacock.
You said something early on when we were talking about the political consequences of this indictment and how it's been probably a positive. He's raised a bunch of money. He seems to have separated himself in the polls, at least in recent days, from Ron DeSantis a bit more. But you said, well, a lot of this depends on what other cases drop. Let's say Georgia brings a case and the documents case is brought by the Department of Justice. Let's put aside January 6th for a moment. Based on your coverage of many elections and the arc of Donald Trump's career, is that going to further galvanize his base or will they fray?
We don't know. I'm loath to predict for many reasons, one of which is just that generally I'm loath to predict. But, you know, I think that it was the Trump folks, you asked how they feel, do see it as something of a gift that the Manhattan DA case went first, because they think that it is the most trivial of the cases. They like to say weak. I don't actually think it is a weak case. I think that if you read that statement of fact that went with the indictment, the question is whether people think that it should have been brought. I think that they have seen a way to get political upside out of it and to try to use it to tarnish whatever else might come as political. But I think that at a certain point, if you're talking about multiple indictments in different jurisdictions, I think that's a lot of freight. You know, right now, Trump is doing, you know, well enough in the Republican primary, in part because the majority of Republican primary voters are not voting on electability, which is really the DeSantis argument, is electability. I don't know if that starts to get chipped away if there's additional indictments.
You mentioned earlier that Trump sat down with you for three interviews when you were doing your book. Why does Trump sit down with you? No offense. Why does he sit down with Bob Woodward? Why does he sit down with people who are going to write books that are not going to be so flattering?
Because he cannot help himself. And in both cases, it's sort of the same thing. With me, it's really about the New York Times and his obsession with the Times. And with Woodward, it's because Woodward is an iconic, legendary name. So that's as simple as that. And because he is utterly convinced, Preet, of his own ability to spin you. You know, I remember asking an aide in 2017 after he had been ripping me about something in public, you know, and then he sat down for an interview with me. And I said, why is he doing this? And they said, he wants to see if he can get a good story. And it really is. I mean, it's as simple as that.
Hope springs eternal.
It's not even hope springs eternal. It's more sort of, I'm so talented at being able to spin people that I'll bet I can do it this time.
Has he ever thought about representing himself in court?
He tells his lawyers that he's the best and that he could do it better than they can. I mean, remember, part of his whole thing is telling people that he understands everything better than they do.
Yes. He's an expert and a stable genius, as he has said himself. You wrote last November that Ronald Lauder was no longer backing his friend of decades, Donald Trump.
Yes.
So we talk about his base a lot. What about the donor class, and do they matter?
You know, I think, Preet, they matter less than they ever did, if I'm being honest. You know, and I think that we lose sight of how, I'll get back to your donor question in a second, but something happened over the weekend where Trump, in his first post indictment event, went to a UFC, whatever you call it, fight. It's not my area, but this was in Miami on, I think, Friday night, not Saturday night. And maybe it was Saturday night. Anyway, he went to this event and he apparently was greeted like a hero. And the crowd reacted in a really electric way. And the reason that matters is it is a bit of a measurable quantity of celebrity that no one else in the Republican field has, and that he has because he was a celebrity for decades. But he was more than just a celebrity. He was a celebrity who connected with a certain section of voters in the country on sort of this shared cultural basis. And so he has a durable level of support that I think people do keep underestimating. There is a certain amount of the Republican base that's going to be with him. And it's more than 25% at this point that's going to be with him, I think, no matter what. And so I do think that that's really important. That with somebody who's got 100% name ID, about whom everyone in the country has an opinion, I mean, literally everyone, donor money makes less of an issue unless that donor money is being put toward negative ads to define an opponent. And that's what Trump has his super PAC for. Now, I don't know what the super PAC has raised. DeSantis's team told me in a story we did last week that they had raised $30 million in the course of just a couple of weeks since they launched. And that's a huge amount of money. It seems pretty clear to me that Trump's amount of money is not that. But I don't know that it has to be that. You know, I think Trump has never been the favorite of the donor class. He certainly wasn't in 2016. He only was by dint of being president for the 4 years after that. That most of these people who supported Trump, you know, among Republican donor class, would never have been with him.
If it's possible, yeah. I think he has 102% name recognition. If I'm doing the math correctly, I think it's at 102%.
I'm not 100% sure, but I'm 100% sure that he has 102% name ID. Yes. So I just don't think that the money matters the same way with him.
Yeah. No, that's probably true for the first time in a big race like this.
I think that's right.
And the other thing, we talk about the effect politically on Trump and how he has to campaign and garner support after the indictment. But the other half of the equation is the quandary that all of his opponents are in, because they also have to, all of them, have to attack the DA and attack the indictment also.
Yep.
Which is, how much of a pickle is that for them?
Well, all you have to do is look at how DeSantis handled it, which was, you know, so Trump, you asked me about why is Trump afraid on an arrest? And I said it's because he's not in control. If you think about how much control is incredibly important to Trump, just look at what he did that Saturday morning where he posted on Truth Social that he was going to be arrested on Tuesday, which was absolutely not true.
He was trying to control his arrest.
He was trying to control everything. He was trying to control, you know, the news cycle. He was trying to control what Republicans said in response. And by the way, it worked. So DeSantis came under 2 days of pressure from Trump allies and Trump's own campaign to say something. He finally spoke at an event in Panama City that Monday. And he was very dismissive of Alvin Bragg, which is not a leap for him because he's been dismissing, you know, liberal prosecutors for a very long time. Alvin Bragg is a liberal prosecutor. And then he said, and this was a twist of the knife at Trump, he said it twice.
I don't know what goes into paying hush money to a porn star to secure silence over some type of alleged affair. I can't speak to that.
That was a dig at Trump's character.
Yes, it
and
was.
It was not received well, Preet, in Trump land. And so that it was taken note of around Trump that when the indictment did happen, DeSantis put out a tweet, you know, within, I think, an hour. And he didn't name Trump, but he called the indictment un-American, said Florida would not be part of any extradition, which wasn't even under discussion at that point. It was pretty telling about the heat that he had felt.
I find it hard to get over where we are and how politics has been turned on its head. And this may be a good thing. I'm not saying it's necessarily a bad thing that people care less about personal issues. But the idea that in a campaign for the presidency or for any other office for that matter, usually it would be the case that opponents would feel like they were handed a gift.
Yes.
If one of their rivals was not only indicted by, you know, a credible prosecutor's office, but also that at the heart of that indictment, whether you like the criminal case or not, is something as tawdry as what it is. That used to be career ending. And now you and I are discussing how that's helpful to Trump politically.
It is.
How'd that happen?
Well, because politics has become redefined by who you hate and who hates you back. And so what matters is not what you did. What matters is who doesn't like what you did, if that makes any sense.
I think it makes a lot of sense. You put that on a t-shirt?
I put it in a book. If people want to buy the book, it was called Confidence Man. But it's a short book. It's very funny. But I did get into that in the book that, you know, this is, I did a story in 2014 when I was still at Politico about how many races that cycle had been marked by people who got elected who had underwater approval ratings. And the volume of people elected with that state of affairs had been really surprising to pollsters, because it used to be, as you know, you needed to be at 50 or higher and in your approval rating. And it was becoming the case that the waterline was just getting lower and lower because voters just felt so gross about politicians in general and expected sort of bad behavior from candidates that they no longer punished them the same way. And I think that's a lot of it.
It's not completely new. Somebody I heard a couple of years ago draw the analogy to the support for O.J. Simpson.
Mm.
Obviously, very different situation, very different alleged crime and everything else. But, you know, the people who are supporting O.J. Simpson, even if they thought maybe he did the deed and killed his wife, further to what you were saying a second ago, he had the right enemy.
Yep.
And that enemy was the LAPD.
Yes.
That had been shown to be, in many ways, racist and oppressive towards the Black community.
Yes.
And that's all that mattered. So, and that's 30 years ago.
That's actually a very good analogy. That was 30 years ago. And I think that was a strain that has now become, you know, sort of more broadly about politics in general and about culture in general.
Are there particular people or one person among his rivals that the Trump team is concerned about in 2024?
They are laser focused on Ron DeSantis.
And as they should be or no?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the polls, Ron DeSantis is the closest to him. I think that Ron DeSantis has shown the most potential for growth. And I think that he's, you know, well, we just discussed how much money is less significant with Trump. He's got a ton of money, so you can't ignore him. And I think that you've seen an investment in DeSantis from some Republicans that you really never saw with any of Trump's rivals in 2015 or 2016, because they didn't take it as seriously then. So
is there someone else that they're worried could sneak by, like Nikki Haley or someone else? Or
not? I think that they worry a bit about Tim Scott. Mm-hmm. But I think that's basically it. And I frankly think that they're hopeful that Tim Scott will end up drawing from DeSantis.
And how does the DeSantis-Trump fight unfold? Trump makes fun of him. Trump calls him names.
I can't believe you say that. That does not sound like the Donald Trump I know. Yeah. I mean, he already is. He's calling it, more than calling him names, he's accusing him of misconduct with students when he was a teenager, when he was a teacher. He insinuated he might be gay. I mean,
where's DeSantis? At some point, when are we going to see DeSantis throw a punch?
So I've asked this question of people around DeSantis a lot. And the response that I get is, you're really not going to see that. That's just not the fight he's planning on having. He doesn't want to let Trump set the terms of engagement. While it's clear to me that he has had trouble figuring out how to tackle certain things about Trump, I do think that DeSantis is not intimidated by Trump. And that's unusual that we've not seen that.
Interesting.
Yeah. Now, that may change, but right now, I don't think he is.
What does that mean, not intimidated? Meaning he thinks he can win, or he's just not going to get bullied?
He definitely thinks that he can win, and that he's not going to get bullied, and that, you know, the sort of the character attacks aren't scaring him off.
Do you think he's learned the lesson, if we can remind people?
Ted Cruz?
It will cause you to... No, I was going to say Marco Rubio.
Mm.
Marco Rubio was the uplifting, inspiring Republican candidate. If you want to ask who I thought was going to be the Republican nominee back in 2015, 2016, I thought it was going to be Rubio. I thought Rubio had a lot of attractive qualities that independents would like. He was from Florida, and he was hopeful and, you know, telegenic and all of that. This was before he had to drink a lot of water when he gave the Republican response to the State of the Union. But so Trump starts attacking him. And then I'll never forget this rally where Marco Rubio gets up on the stage and he decides he's going to be Trump. and made fun of Trump's
hand size, among other things. Yeah.
He's always calling me Little Marco. And I'll admit, the guy, he's taller than me. He's like 6'2", which is why I don't understand why his hands are the size of someone who's 5'2". Have you seen his hands? And you know what they say about men with small hands? You can't trust them. You can't trust them.
And it, you know, it didn't work.
Nope.
It didn't work. And it's not going to work for DeSantis either. So in some ways, Trump has a, you know, I hate to say, he has a Trump card because he can do that and the other people can't.
There's no question that, I mean, one of Trump's hallmarks has always been, and calling cards has always been, that he can get away with things that other people can't. And that he can behave in certain ways that only work for him, and that when other people try, it doesn't.
It's not even a moral issue. It's not like other people. It's just not effective.
It just doesn't succeed. That's correct. And so
it's like if Trump's calling card was juggling, you know, bowling pins, and he was really good at juggling bowling, and he was the best bowling pin juggler. And DeSantis or Rubio or Ted Cruz or whoever the opponent is thought, well, voters really like juggling. I'm going to juggle, but you can't juggle as well.
Right.
It's making it worse. And so they always struggle for a lane. So what's the lane that defeats Trump, if any?
Well, here's the thing. The lane that defeats Trump is the lane where voters suddenly decide that the conduct bothers them. Right. Because, I mean, if you look at DeSantis and Trump, they're not especially different on policy. You know, DeSantis has been trying to get to the right of Trump on a number of fronts. There has been a belief among Republican strategists for some time now that Trump has certain vulnerabilities on the right. One of them is COVID related, although I'm really not sure how animating that is in a Republican primary at this point. I think it was a price of entry for DeSantis, but I think it's being overinterpreted as the reason voters are voting. Number one. Number two is crime. Number three is immigration. You're seeing DeSantis doing all sorts of work on that right now. And number four is China, and that Trump was, you know, sort of he was praising of Xi at various points during his presidency, and he was seen as too soft early on in the pandemic. Although part of the reason for that was not just that he wanted to preserve his trade deal with China, but part of it was also that the U.S. was reliant on China for certain medical shipments. And so it was a complicated rationale, but nonetheless, it all adds up to a sense of perceived weakness on the right. I think DeSantis has been hoping to exploit that, but generally speaking, their policies are not particularly different. And, you know, what ends up happening is where they are different though, Preet, is for instance, I don't think you're going to hear Trump support a 6-week abortion ban. I think you'll try to hear him be as nonspecific as possible, but privately, and I reported this last year, he was telling people that the end of Roe v. Wade was bad for Republicans. You're seeing Trump's super PAC hit DeSantis really hard on his votes related to Medicare and Social Security when he was a Congress member. And so you're going to see sort of a typical politicianing of Ron DeSantis in that way. But in general, what the lane for DeSantis is, you know, hoping that people want Trump, you know, without the drama. And the drama is not only priced in, but for a bunch of people, it's part of the appeal.
So let's say it's Biden versus Trump in the general election with maybe a trial concluded or trials pending. Putting that aside, you know, the indictment issue, how is the 2024 general election going to look different from the 2020 general election?
So that's a great question that I've been thinking a lot about in the last 2 weeks, ever since a story by Alex Thompson at Axios about how Biden might push his campaign announcement off to the summer. And there's a number of Democrats who I've talked to who have been kind of hand-wringy about it, which is, you know, does this mean that Biden's not going to get in? If he doesn't get in, it's so late for everybody to form their own campaign. I have no reason to believe that Biden's not running, so let me just put that out there. And if you accept that, which I do, I accept he is running, part of how he can recreate the conditions of 2020, which really were Biden barely visible and Trump sort of hanging himself on a daily basis and blowing himself up on a daily basis, you're seeing some of that right now, right? Biden's trying to step back, do presidential work, does not feel an overweening need to be in headlines every single day, and is letting Trump get massive press attention, you know, despite this belief that all press attention is great for Trump. In a general election, it's not. And so, you know, getting headlines for getting indicted is not actually a winning argument with independents. or suburban moderates. So,
That's Biden.
That's Biden.
What's Trump going to do different?
Nothing. And it'll be more cowbell. I mean, really, I think you will just see a really savagely run campaign. That's all.
So now I'm going to do this hypothetical, which doesn't please me. Trump wins the presidency and he's not in prison. How does the Trump 2 term in office compare to Trump 1?
I wrote a story about this a couple of weeks ago. It will be, you know, I wrote it with, I think, my colleague Shane Goldmacher after Trump's speech at CPAC, where he described himself as your retribution. It will be, you know, I think a term largely of spite. It will be, you know, it will be finishing certain things that didn't get dealt with, but those things tend to be less policy and more personnel related. It'll be making sure he gets in people who will do what he wants and doing what he wants.
Yeah. I mean, who's the attorney general going to
be? Well, I mean, it's a great question. It's certainly not going to be Bill Barr again, you know, so I don't know. It's certainly not going to be Jeff Sessions again.
Jeff Clark?
But it's a great question of who could even get confirmed, right? I mean, he'll have a much easier time staffing a White House with political appointments than he will having to get Senate confirmed cabinet posts. And it depends on what happens with the Senate.
I was going to say, a universe in which Trump wins the presidency seems to be a universe in which the Republicans win back the Senate.
I think that is correct. I think that
so. You could
correct.
Have a Trump 2, spiteful, vengeful, policy of retribution, in his own words, in January 2025.
Yes.
Where he has the presidency, the House, and the Senate.
Yep. Yep.
That was a moment of silence.
I mean, yes, you could have.
I was doing a moment of silence.
Yes, you could have all of. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt it. You can have all of that. I mean, this is. I think that, and you could also not have that, Preet. Right. I mean, I think there is a reason to look at the last three cycles, 22, 2018, and look at diminishing returns for Republicans across the board.
Do you have a particular role, as far as your beat goes? In the 2024
No.
primaries in general, do you want to cover DeSantis? Do you want to cover Trump? Do you not want to cover Trump?
Well, it'll be up to my bosses what I do, but I will be.
Yeah, but what's your problem? You can tell them right now through the power of the podcast.
I appreciate that.
What would you like to be doing in 2024?
I anticipate that if Trump is the nominee, I'll be covering him. If DeSantis is the nominee, I'll be covering him. If Tim Scott's nominee, I'll be covering him. But I will be covering politics generally.
You know, one of the questions that I was going to ask you, but we sort of covered a little bit, was whether or not the donor class has Trump fatigue, whether or not, you know, independents have Trump fatigue. What about Maggie Haberman? Do you have Trump fatigue? Nobody's worried about you. I'm worried about you.
You know, that's appreciate that. You've known me a long time though. I think that, you know, my father is a journalist, as you know, and some of your listeners probably know. And I learned a lesson from him, which is that a journalist doesn't leave the story and the story is not over. So that's how I look at it.
You're like in the military.
There you go. Or something. It's just what I do.
It's your mission.
Look, I think we're not curing cancer, right? I mean, I don't want to, there are a lot of people who are working.
Are you denigrating the First Amendment of the United States Constitution?
Wow. Okay. Yes. Thank you for that. No. But I do think the work we do is important. And I think that it is important in a democracy. And the story is still ongoing.
We talked about how Trump might be different in 2024. Biden might be different. How do you think the press corps generally, putting you aside for a moment, will the press corps generally be? I mean, it already is very different from 2016,
I think so.
Certainly.
Yeah. And I
will
think
it be different from 2020?
I don't know how to answer that because 2020 was such a strange year because of COVID, right? I mean, I think we'll be covering events. We'll be covering, you know, candidates will be campaigning in ways that they were not in 2020. So I think that's going to be, there will be something to be at in a way there just wasn't in 2020. But, you know, I think that, look, I think the press is really aware of trying to call out. I think the press has done a really good job over the last 2 years in the face of a lot of attacks of calling out lies about the election, of calling out denialism. And I expect that denialism will continue, I expect that will continue too.
Is Biden the Democrat in the general that the Trump folks find the most formidable, notwithstanding what they say?
I mean, they don't really, you know, a number of them don't really look that far. into it in terms of...
That reminds me of another question I'm going to ask you in a moment.
Okay. I think that they assume that Biden is the nominee and they like their chances against him. Whether they should or shouldn't, they like their chances against him.
The question I was reminded of is, I think you say in your book, that the Trump, maybe his team also, but certainly Trump, lives in the eternal now. And that's why nobody in the White House did any long-term planning. I guess my question, this is sort of a political science question. How does a person who does nothing but live in the eternal now become as successful as he is and become the president? Usually it takes planning, it some understanding of object permanence. You know, those kinds of things matter. Is it just, again, he had the right enemies?
Well, no, I think it was a combination of factors. I do think he had the right enemy in the sense that he was running against a very polarizing opponent. You know, I think the email hacks that the intelligence community says Russia did helped. I think this was a very close election in 2016. And so there's a million factors when it's a close election. But I also think that part of it is he gets dinged a lot, you know, with reason for his work ethic, but he actually outworked Clinton in 2016. And he actually seemed to be enjoying himself, which I am hard pressed to point to many points when he really has in the last 2 years, you know, especially as he's been doing these events in the last couple of months. And this goes back to my point about his durable support, you know, going back decades as being a celebrity. People felt really bonded to him and believed that he was this uber wealthy guy. He's wealthier than 99% of the country. So as much as the conversation is about that he's not really that rich, he's a lot richer than most of us, you know, even if he's not as rich as he says he is. But whatever was said about him and his business practices, people didn't believe it because they had watched The Apprentice or they had read The Art of the Deal. And so he had just been branded as this success story for so long that it was an impenetrable artifice. And I think that was a big part of it too.
Maggie Haberman, the book, I'll remind people, because it's still very relevant, Confidence Man, The Making of Donald Trump, and The Breaking of America. Thanks for being on the show again.
Thank you for having me.
My conversation with Maggie Haberman continues for members of the Cafe Insider community. We discuss the value she still sees in using Twitter for her reporting.
You know, even in its currently sort of distorted form, it is still a real tool in terms of promoting your reporting, in terms of seeing other people's reporting, in terms of seeing what information is coming out.
To try out the membership for just $1 for a month, head to cafe.com/insider. Again, that's cafe.com/insider. In our current moment of global anxiety, an ongoing war in Europe, rising tensions among world powers, it can be easy to feel cynical about the power of diplomacy. But I wanted to end the show this week by remembering a time when diplomacy worked, when peace was brokered and bloodshed ended. On Tuesday, President Biden and former President Clinton traveled to Belfast in Northern Ireland to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement. That's the peace accord that put an end to the so-called Troubles, the 30-year period of sectarian violence that ravaged Northern Ireland and also brought death and destruction to cities like Dublin and London. The epicenter of the conflict was Belfast, a city that was divided between communities of largely Protestant Unionists who wanted Northern Ireland to remain with the UK and the mostly Catholic Nationalists who wanted to join with the Republic of Ireland. Neighbors became enemies, and neighborhoods became battlefields. Bombings were commonplace. People's children were abducted and murdered. All told, throughout the course of the Troubles, an estimated 3,600 people died. In 1998, with the United States playing a central role, UK Prime Minister Tony Blair and Irish Taoiseach Bertie Ahern came to the negotiating table, and they set up a power-sharing arrangement that gave both sides representation. The warring factions disarmed in favor of a democratic process. The deal also created an open border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. Now, a generation later, things aren't perfect. Tensions remain, and schools and neighborhoods in Northern Ireland are still largely segregated. The fallout from Brexit has introduced a new series of debates over borders and trade. But the deal brokered in 1998 effectively put an end to the political violence. And in the decades since, the peace has, for the most part, held. That's no small thing. The Good Friday Agreement is a lesson that opposing factions, even those made up of people who view the other side as terrorists, can come together to forge agreement and to save lives. What a powerful reminder for our current moment. Well, that's it for this episode of Stay Tuned. Thanks again to my guest, Maggie Haberman. If you like what we do, rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Every positive review helps new listeners find the show. Send me your questions about news, politics, and justice. Tweet them to me at Preet Bharara with the hashtag AskPreet, or you can call and leave me a message at 669-247-7338. That's 669-24-PREET. Or you can send an email to letters@cafe.com. Stay Tuned is presented by CAFE and the Vox Media Podcast Network. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The technical director is David Tatasciore. The senior producers are Adam Waller and Matthew Billy. The CAFE team is David Kurlander, Sam Ozer-Staten, Noah Azulai, Nat Wiener, Jake Kaplan, Namita Shah, and Claudia Hernandez. Our music is by Andrew Dost. I'm your host, Preet Bharara. Stay tuned.